Allora, buon pomeriggio a tutte e a tutti. Sono Stefano Sacchi e introduco la Theseus Lecture del professor Philippe Rehm. Questo è segnato sul programma come un dialogo, a dire il vero, è una lezione che ho chiamato Theseus Lecture, dove Theseus sta per tecnologia, società, umanità, e questo nuovo centro interdipartimentale del Politecnico di Torino, che è appena nato e che inizierà le sue attività a partire da gennaio, e ha una finalità nobile, che è quella dell'integrazione tra le scienze applicate, in particolare la tecnologia, le scienze umane e le scienze sociali. E la base di partenza è un centro di ricerca interdipartimentale che coinvolge quindi tutti i dipartimenti del Politecnico di Torino, sia ingegneria sia d'architettura. La base di partenza condivisa è che la tecnologia non è neutrale, non è neutrale né quello che i politologi chiamano gli input, i throughput e gli output, cioè non è neutrale relativamente alle sue basi sociali, economiche, culturali, legali, non è neutrale relativamente ai processi decisionali sui quali impatta e che la vedono coinvolta, non è neutrale relativamente ai suoi esiti, gli esiti della tecnologia, gli esiti sociali, economici, in termini di diritti individuali, sono importanti e dobbiamo studiarli. Spesso queste cose vengono studiate o dagli scienziati, dagli umanisti o dagli scienziati sociali come i politologi o gli economisti o i sociologi, oppure affrontati dal punto di vista tecnico dagli ingegneri, dai tecnologi. L'idea di Theseus e del Politecnico di Torino è quella di integrare questi punti di vista attraverso queste prospettive, attraverso alcune attività. In primo luogo un'attività rivolta all'interno primariamente, ma non solo, con una finalità culturale, cioè quella di promuovere questa integrazione e mostrare l'attrazione, la potenza che il lavorare assieme tecnologi, scienziati sociali e scienziati dell'uomo può avere. E questo avverrà attraverso seminari, workshop, summer school, seminari che vedranno avvio da gennaio alcuni dei temi sono il tema della diplomazia scientifica e come la diplomazia scientifica possa risolvere dei problemi anche relativi ai conflitti tra le nazioni, con un fuoco su quello che sta accadendo attualmente in Ucraina, oppure anche l'utilizzo, cosa che risuona con la lecture di oggi, l'utilizzo dell'artificial intelligence e big data nella presa delle decisioni, ad esempio nella presa delle decisioni relativamente a dare sussidi di disoccupazione o reddito di cittadinanza, eccetera, eccetera. E altri esempi sono il dialogo tra tecnologi, filosofi, scienziati sociali relativamente a tecniche di procreazione assistita. Anche per risolvere problemi di natalità. E allora quali sono queste tecniche? Quali limiti hanno? Quali limiti incontrano dal punto di vista dell'accettabilità? Eccetera, eccetera. Tema probabilmente caldo nei prossimi mesi in Italia. Una seconda dimensione è quella della formazione. Qui abbiamo, lo sapete, molti di voi che studiano in questo Ateneo, al secondo anno di ingegneria, in tutti i corsi di ingegneria del BA, della triennale, dovete prendere i corsi Grandi Sfide, che sono coinsegnati da un tecnologo, una tecnologa e uno scienziato, scienziata sociale o dell'uomo. Però, e quindi l'idea è quella di contaminare l'ingegneria con le scienze umane e sociali, ma anche, e questa è una missione del Politecnico di Torino per gli anni a venire, contaminare in realtà chi prende le decisioni con degli elementi, come dire, di conoscenza delle tecnologie per poter prendere delle decisioni migliori. La prima cosa che abbiamo fatto è un Master in Technology and Public Policy che partirà tra poco con l'ILO, con l'ITC ILO qui a Torino. Abbiamo degli accordi come Politecnico con varie scuole di politica, dei vari partiti politici, per insegnare a tutti i partiti politici, come dire, alcuni elementi di tecnologia che sono rilevanti nella presa delle decisioni, e lavoreremo anche con la pubblica amministrazione per formare i funzionari della pubblica amministrazione relativamente alle decisioni che coinvolgono la tecnologia. L'ultima dimensione di questa, diciamo, nuova avventura e nuova ridefinizione di sé del Politecnico di Torino riguarda il supporto al decision making e al policy making in particolare, che poggia sull'analisi degli impatti della tecnologia, quindi su un'analisi diciamo accademica e scientifica, e che però la renda accessibile ai policy makers attraverso policy brief, attraverso dei briefings di chi effettivamente prende le decisioni. Allora, la lecture di oggi è così importante proprio perché attraversa trasversalmente tutti questi aspetti. Tratta di un aspetto fondamentale, quale, come dire, l'evoluzione del welfare state, che noi tutti diamo per scontato, no? Le nostre pensioni, se ci va molto male i sussidi di disoccupazione, ma se ci va bene le pensioni, la sanità, l'accesso ai servizi sanitari, tutte cose che diamo per scontate e che però, come vedremo, scontate non sono nella loro evoluzione storica e non sono forse neanche per il futuro, che si basano su una condivisione, su una nozione di solidarietà sociale, che però, come dire, ha certi prerequisiti. Come diceva un tale, il welfare state non è semplicemente politiche sociali, è un'esplicita ridefinizione di tutto ciò che lo Stato è, di tutto ciò che lo Stato fa e di tutto ciò che lo Stato si ritiene che debba fare. La lezione del professor Rehm, al quale do la parola tra pochi istanti, va a vedere come tutto questo potrebbe cambiare con l'acquisizione di nuove informazioni, con la disponibilità di informazioni, da cui il titolo della lecture e anche il titolo di questo libro che vi consiglio davvero di leggere, per Cambridge University Press, che il professor Rehm ha scritto con Torben Iversen di Harvard, Big Data and the Welfare State, cioè come la rivoluzione che coinvolge l'acquisizione di informazioni mette a rischio, minaccia la solidarietà sociale. Ma ho preso fin troppo tempo, voglio introdurvi il professor Rehm, che ha preso il dottorato a Duke, è docente di scienza politica, adesso a Johns Hopkins a Baltimora, in trasferimento, diciamo, da Ohio State University a Johns Hopkins a Baltimora. È stato tra le altre cose postdoc a Oxford, al Nuffield College. La sua ricerca è all'intersezione tra la politica, l'economy e gli studi del comportamento politico, con un particolare riferimento alle politiche sociali, e quindi in particolare lo studio delle cause, delle conseguenze, delle dinamiche dei redditi, la perdita di reddito, la sua volatilità, l'esposizione a rischi di perdita di reddito, sia a livello individuale micro, sia a livello di sistema politico macro. A livello micro, quindi, il professor Rehm ha studiato come le dinamiche dei redditi influenzano le preferenze dei cittadini per la redistribuzione, le politiche sociali e i partiti politici, comportamento politico. A livello macro, l'impatto delle dinamiche dei redditi e delle dinamiche del mercato del lavoro sulla polarizzazione, un concetto che tornerà, credo, nella sua lecture, sulle maggioranze elettorali e sulle coalizioni di sostegno alle politiche sociali, perché noi diamo per scontato di avere delle politiche sociali, ma queste sono mantenute o sono modificate da coalizioni di sostegno. Allora, su Questi temi ha scritto innumerevoli articoli, quindi non posso citarli tutti perché esaurirei l'ora a nostra disposizione. Li ha scritti da solo o con altri grandi della scienza politica contemporanea come Torben Iversen, Jacob Hacker o Herbert Kitchelt, e ha scritto in particolare due volumi: Risk Inequality and the Welfare State, che è un jazz standard, diciamo, per chi si occupa di questi temi, e Big Data and the Welfare State. E su Big Data and the Welfare State siamo tutti ansiosi di dare il benvenuto al professor Rehm per la Teseus Lecture a Biennale Tecnologia 2022. Molte grazie.
Hello, good evening, good afternoon everybody. Thank you for this very generous introduction. It sounded very nice. No, I understand a little bit. I lived 1 year in Florence, and it was the highest quality of life of my year. So welcome everybody. I have the thank you for this invitation. It's just absolutely wonderful to be here. I have the pleasure to present this book, which is called Big Data and the Welfare State. This is joint work with Torben Iversen, who is a brilliant scholar who unfortunately couldn't be here today, and I'm as disappointed as you are. The only upside is that he can't make fun of me. The last time he saw me at an academic event in a suit, he asked me whether this was my wedding. And while I would like to do my... while it seems like Turin is a place where you want to do your honeymoon, I've married a long time ago, so that's not why I'm here. Why I'm here is I want to tell you about this book, and I want to tell you what we're trying to do in this book. So the ambition in this book is to understand how information shapes welfare state politics and the politics of inequality. And since information has changed over time, we want to tell a dynamic story. And as you can see from the subtitle, which is How the Information Revolution Threatens Social Solidarity, it's not a very happy story. So the conclusion that we draw is not particularly optimistic. All right, so the big picture, the big idea or the sort of main story that we want to tell is that we as societies went from a world where information was low and asymmetric. That was the world 50, 100, 150 years ago or so, which was conducive to a lot of things. For example, people had little knowledge about their own risk. People had common preferences as a result. Markets were not possible. This was the old world. And that has changed. The veil of ignorance, the Rawlsian veil of ignorance, has been lifted. And we are now moving towards a world, or we already have arrived at a world, where there's a lot more information and information is more shareable. And it has certain consequences. There's much more knowledge about risk. Polarized, the preferences over welfare state politics get more polarized, and finally markets are possible. And I'll explain these things one by one, but that's the big story, and that's why we argue welfare state politics becomes more contested and social solidarity comes under threat. We developed the story in four arguments, and I'll spend the most time on the first argument. I'll go over all four arguments, but this is really the core, and I'll spend most of the time on it. So the first argument is that information is absolutely critical for insurance markets. And that's not a new insight. This is so old, this insight, that I've been taught it when I studied microeconomics a long time ago in Tübingen. Nobel Prizes have been awarded for this idea. It's really well known, well understood. It's a fascinating research topic, but there's nothing original about it. What we try to do is here is we try to apply the same logic to the welfare state. And the welfare state, by many people, has been understood as a system of risk management that has many similarities to insurance. And so we call the welfare state in this literature also social insurance. And that's what we're going to do here. If insurance markets are affected by information dynamics, then social insurance or the welfare state are also going to be affected by information. And we're trying to understand what is going on and how information has changed. And there's really two aspects of information that are relevant. The first one is the level of information. The second one is the shareability of information. So with respect to the level of information, we distinguish a world of low information where people simply don't know their position in the risk distribution, right? If they don't know how likely they're going to be unemployed, they don't know how likely they're going to be sick, they don't know how likely they're going to die early, they don't know how likely their spouse is going to die before them, things like that. And that's a low information world where people don't know their position in the risk distribution, and it's so little information that we really can say it's a world of uncertainty. If we are in a world of uncertainty, the best guess you can have about your position is that you think you're average, right? If the only thing that you can observe in a society is the average unemployment rate, but you don't know whether yours is high or low, your best guess is I'm an average risk. And everybody under uncertainty has the same guess. And so everybody in that society roughly wants the same thing from social protection because they all have the same risk profile or the same perceived risk profile, namely being average. And that's really good for setting up, agreeing on certain things, having common preferences, wanting the same kind of social protection system. Now, if you have more and better information, essentially what happens is that world of uncertainty goes away. You're lifting that veil of ignorance that Rawls has been using as a metaphor, and we're going from a world where people are uncertain about their position to a world where they have actually a pretty good idea about where they are in the risk distribution. They know whether they're high or low risk in terms of unemployment. They know whether they're likely to develop certain diseases or not. In fact, with DNA tests, we can predict certain very serious diseases with certainty, right? Give me a drop of your blood and I can tell you whether you're going to develop certain diseases. So we're going to this world of more and better information. And if that's true, then people know their position and the risk distribution, and it allows them to better align their interests and their risk profile and their political interests and preferences. So what the level of information does is people become more aware of the risk profile, which leads to more differentiated preferences for the welfare state. The second dimension of information that's relevant is the ability to share. And why does that matter? Well, this is a critical insight from this insurance literature that I mentioned, that if you cannot share information and if you have asymmetric information, then it's really difficult to set up insurance markets, and usually it's not possible. So the problems that arise, I'll give you examples in a moment, are related to asymmetric information. The typical case is someone wants to take out insurance, say car insurance, and the person that wants to take out insurance knows whether they're good or bad drivers, but the insurance company does not know that. They cannot observe whether you're a good or bad driver. And that generates problems for the insurance market. And in fact, the problems are so severe that normally we cannot have in private insurance market under uncertainty, under asymmetric information. However, if all of a sudden we can share information and both parties have the same amount of information, then we can set up markets. So if risk can be observed and credibly shared with insurers, that will ameliorate this or get rid of this asymmetric information problem. And that will allow the insurance company to build more fine-grained risk classification and engage in more fine-grained risk discrimination. So they will be able to set up markets. So markets can exist if information becomes more shareable. I know this is fairly abstract, and so I want to give you an example that you probably can relate to, or many of you can relate to. And that's the example of the car insurance market. So the car insurance market is not something that we usually study as political scientists, and it's not part of the welfare state. But what I'm going to argue is the dynamics that we're observing in the car insurance markets are happening in other insurance markets, including in the personal insurance market, like life insurance and health insurance, and so on and so forth as well. So what's the problem in the car insurance market? In the car insurance market, which exists for, 120 years or so, the insurance companies cannot observe your driving behavior. But they would really like to charge bad drivers higher rates than they like to charge good drivers, right? Everybody's premium should be roughly proportional to their driving behavior. But insurance companies cannot observe driving behavior. So the insurance company has now two options. It can put out two contracts. One is for good drivers, and it's cheap, and the other one is for bad drivers, and it's expensive. And what's going to happen is everybody's going to say, I'm a good driver, give me the cheap insurance. If that happens, the insurance company goes bankrupt. All right? The other option that the insurance company has is it puts out one contract, which is the average of the good and bad insurance premium, which is unattractive for the good drivers because it's too high. So what happens, only bad drivers take out that insurance product, and the insurance company once again goes bankrupt. So this is an example of how asymmetric information leads to adverse selection, leads to non-existent of private markets. Private markets cannot exist under these conditions normally. Now, there are, as you know, car insurance markets, and the way they have solved this problem is they charge you premiums based on stuff they can actually observe. They cannot observe your driving behavior, but they can observe your age, your gender, the car you drive, the horsepower your car have, the color of your car, where you live, things like that. And they use all this information, they use historical data, and they put you in a group of people that have similar characteristics, and they charge everybody in that group a certain premium. All right? So it's an average premium, and that's the only of one of two equations you see today. The premium is P bar. P is the premium. Bar means it's an average for a group, and G means it's a group. All right? Now, what has changed recently, about 10 years ago, is that insurance companies have figured out how to actually observe driving behavior. And the way they do it is they take a little device that looks like this and stick it in your car. They can do the same thing with a phone, but that's more dramatic, so that's why I'm telling you this story. So they can stick it in your car. Every car has a little port under the steering wheel where you can put that device. And that device measures all sorts of things, many of which are actuarially relevant. It can measure, for example, when you drive, how fast you drive, how fast you drive relative to the speed limit, right? You match the data with GPS and you know whether someone is speeding, how hard you corner, how hard you brake, how often you brake, how many emergency braking events you have, things like that. Whether you drive during the night or during the day, all of these things can be measured and credibly transmitted and instantly transmitted to the insurance company. And that allows the insurance company to essentially crunch the numbers and give you a rate, a premium, that is exactly actuarially proportional to your probability of having an accident, which is what the insurance company wants to do. And therefore, your premium is a very fine-grained, in fact, individualized risk premium. So let's look at that and compare these two. These tariffs exist. They exist in Italy as well, exist in many countries. They're called pay-as-you-drive insurance contracts. And these premiums are directly based on your driving behavior. So this premium, let's call it PI. Okay, notice that this little P on the right does not have a bar, so it's not an average, it's for you. And it has an I, not a G, it's for the individual, it's not for the group. If you're a good driver, you're going to compare PI and P bar G. All right, so PI for good drivers is lower, right? Because you're not going to subsidize the bad drivers in your group. The good drivers like pay-as-you-drive insurance. And so what they're going to do is they're going to buy pay-as-you-drive insurance. And that makes the average risk in the traditional insurance market slightly worse, right? Because the good people just left. Now, that pushes up the premiums, the P bar Gs, in the remaining traditional product, and that pushes out the next good drivers from the traditional market into the and pushes them into the pay-as-you-drive. And that is a classic insurance death spiral that only ends when everybody has been pushed from the traditional pooled market into this individualized pay-as-you-drive market, okay? Now, I don't think that's bad. I don't worry about this at all. If you drive like a maniac, you probably should pay higher insurance premiums. And it might actually be beneficial in the sense that you might internalize the costs of your reckless driving, and therefore you drive better. And that might make everybody better off. That's fine. However, where I do worry is areas where you do not really have control over PI, where you do not have control over your risk behavior or your risk profile, right? You can't control really whether you're going to have a certain disease or not, or only very limited. So the problem is that the exact same dynamics that we observe in the car insurance market are going on and will, we predict, continue to go on in the personal insurance market. And I'm particularly mean things like life insurance and health insurance, but we see this also in a similar way in credit markets, in pension markets, and so on and so forth. My examples will be mostly from the life insurance market and the health insurance market, just because it's the most simple analogy to the car insurance market. So we have more and better data in the life insurance market. This slide consists exclusively, because I couldn't resist putting up this wonderful joke, a wise doctor once wrote, and then you can't read it, right? So this is exactly how medical information was stored until a few years ago. Your doctor would scribble something on paper in a file, stick it in a big box in the office, locks the office, and that's it. Your medical information is locked, virtually inaccessible for other people because you can't read the font, and it's with the doctor. Now, in the US, and I assume the same happened in many other countries, since 2014 or so, there are laws on the books that first incentivize and now force hospitals and doctors to put everything in writing, in typing. I don't know what happens if you go to the doctor here, but if you go to the doctor in the US, they always sit, there's always a sort of a computer with them where they're typing, right? My family doctor resigned because he was so annoyed by this. He went into early retirement. So they're just typing everything, and now they're speaking, and it gets sort of translated into text. And all of this is stored in the cloud in certain software systems. And that is known as an electronic health record, okay? And so since 2018 or so, in the US at least, every record has to be electronic. And there is virtually hundreds of firms that have figured out this is very interesting information, and they have engaged in making all of this information what's called liquid. You can move it from one database to another database, you can merge it with other databases, and so on and so forth. So all of a sudden, all of this information that used to exist just in a doctor's office in a drawer is now available to doctors. They supposedly can improve your healthcare with this, but also to insurance companies. And in fact, insurance companies now routinely use this information in the overwhelming amount of applications for life insurance. This information is being used for underwriting purposes. They know your records, your medical records. They can look at your x-rays. They can look at your prescription drugs. They know all of this. They have it right there in front of them. So that's an example of more and better information in the life insurance market. Also, increasingly, these companies merge data from different sources. So, for example, if you take out life insurance in the US, they're going to look at your health records. They're going to look at your driving record. Turns out they're looking at your criminal record. They're looking at all sorts of things that they can find. Increasingly, there are some sort of firms that use social media accounts to decide whether they want to engage in underwriting or not. Right? For example, if you say you don't smoke, they can check your credit history, your credit cards. They can check your Facebook and so on and so forth, whether you actually do smoke or not. So that's just more and better information that's being used for risk discrimination. There's also more shareable information, and the examples are your Fitbit or Apple Watch or your phone that has all sorts of information recorded if you let it, such as how many steps you take, how many calories you burn, when you sleep, whether you sleep, how your heart rate is, and things like that. And there are insurance products where your premium depends on the number of steps you take, right? If you take 10,000 steps a day, there is a certain health insurance in the US that lowers your premium by a dollar or so a day. Okay, things like that. Typical tracking. And then the big one is, of course, things related to finding out how your DNA shapes your future medical history. And as I mentioned, we can now predict with certainty whether you develop certain diseases. We can say with probability that you may be a risk factor, that you have a higher risk of developing, say, dementia, which is something health insurance companies really don't want to insure, things like that. So you can see how there's more and more information, and that information is easily accessible for the insurance company, right? All you have to do is you have to give them salvia or blood or something like that. So it's not something where you know more than the information the insurance company. All right. This is happening already. This is an actual ad I got to see when I was reading The Guardian. And it asked me, are you over 40 and can still run a 9-minute mile? Now, by the time I get to see this ad, I suspect they perfectly know well the answer, even though I don't. I have no idea whether I can run a 9-minute mile or not. I don't know what it means. It means 1.6 kilometers in 9 minutes. I don't know whether anybody here is running. If you're running, this makes perfect sense for you. It doesn't make any sense to me. But it means you can run really fast. So why doesn't life insurance company want to sign people that are fairly old and can run really fast? Well, it's a simple game. A life insurance contract is very simple. It says, you pay me 20 years, a certain premium, me, the life insurance company, and if you die during those 20 years, I pay a certain sum to the survivors, right? However, if you don't die, I keep the money. It's not quite as simple, but that's the basic idea. So the life insurance company wants to sign you up if you don't die, right? That's the whole business model. So they really want to assess your mortality risk. And that's why it's very difficult for someone who's 90 years old to take out life insurance, right? Because the life insurance company knows that if you're 90 years old, the probability that you're not going to live for another 20 years is very high. While when you're 20 years old, they know the probability that you die within the next 20 years is probably relatively low. However, they get better and better at predicting your mortality risk, your probability of dying, and they use this kind of measures and tracking that I mentioned. So what they do is they figured out if you're 40 years old and can run really fast, then you're not going to die very likely, and then they want to sign you. And this is why I got to see this this ad. You can, and I encourage you, if you browse the web, look for these kinds of things. Since I've done this research, it's everywhere. So if you do yoga, they like to sign you. If you're vegetarian, they like to sign you. If you regularly swim, they like to sign you. If you bike a lot, they like to sign you. And if you generally have healthy lifestyles in a verifiable fashion, then they would like to have you as a customer because they think that you're a good mortality risk. And in the book, what we call this picking the cream puffs. You're selling insurance to people that least need it if you're a private insurance company. All right, and they're not subtle about this at all, right? So this is a company, a subsidiary of Google or Alphabet called Granular, which I think is a brilliant name, right? It means fine-grain insurance. And if you go to their website, that's what it says. We are very good at risk discrimination. We take the people in your risk pool, we parcel them into very small groups, in this case, 22 different groups, and therefore, we know who's going to be expensive and who's going to be cheap for your insurance company, and we want to shift the burden of the insurance amounts from the company to the individual. This is a company that helps insurance companies to make money. And you find all of this exactly on their websites. There's nothing subtle about this at all. And these are the dynamics we try to describe. So more and better information, higher shareability, ameliorates the asymmetric information problem, it enables risk discrimination, and it enables markets. And that's where we're moving towards. And that contrasts with a world where these things were not possible, a world of uncertainty 50, 100, 150 years ago or so, where people didn't really know what their risk is, where insurance companies couldn't observe it, where, in fact, insurance companies didn't exist. They were invented a little later. That's the first argument. The second argument is, and I hope this is totally clear at this point, this will polarize public opinion over the welfare state. This will make some people want public provision and want more or want public provision less than in the past, right? As people better know their position in the risk distribution, as risk becomes more predictable and as markets become more viable, support for risk pooling among those that are good risks is going to go down. People don't want the public option if they have the private option. If they can have a private insurance, they don't want to be in that group insurance. Remember PBARG, that thing, that's public insurance. They want to have the individualized premium because it's cheaper for them. And so that makes polarization about social protection and the welfare state increase. So that's the second argument, polarization on the welfare state is going up. So that then is what we call a triple challenge to the welfare state. First, information directly increases polarization and policy preference as people become more aware of the risk profile. Secondly, more information makes private markets more feasible. And thirdly, if there are private markets, that further polarizes public opinion. Think about higher education or education more generally. If you cannot have, for whatever reason, private education for your children, and you really care about education, you're going to invest and try to make the public system better. However, if you have an option for your kid to go to a private school, you all of a sudden lose interest in the public system, and you're going to take the money and support the school where your child goes. And so these are the kinds of dynamics where a private option, if you have a private option, that really changes your preferences towards the public option. And I think that's the future that we might be going for. So putting these two arguments together, We have the level of insurance of information, which could be high and low. We have the shareability of information, which could be again low and high. And we started up here in that solidaristic welfare state equilibrium where the level of information was low and the shareability was low, so there were no private markets. Now, if in that world information increases, we go from the solidaristic welfare state to a more contested welfare state because now people know ex ante whether they're losers or winners of the public solution. If we also increase the shareability of information, so we go from here to here, we end up in this box here, which is segmented private insurance. So we end up in a world where private markets are possible, where people want to have private insurance, or at the minimum, they want the public option to be segmented. They want to have sort of risk classes within the public system. And that's where we're heading. The third argument is one that's essentially a scope argument. It says this information dynamic that I just described in the first two arguments applies to many insurance domains or many social policy domains, but not all of them. And the reason it doesn't apply to all of them is that there are certain types of problems the welfare state solves that have little to do with information or that cannot be, that don't change with more information. And just to put it very briefly, there are certain things that markets can do. And the two domains that come to mind is health insurance for old people, which is, so health insurance is really concentrated by age, and the other one is poverty. So these are types of risks that private markets simply cannot provide because there is a time inconsistency problem involved, and the best way to solve them is pay-as-you-go system, where one generation pays for the next generation, and markets cannot really make sure this happens. And so these are areas where even though the information revolution increases risk, increases information, increases the shareability of information, they will not be as much subject to the dynamics that we described. But most areas will be, and there's a figure or a table in our book where we identify areas that will be subject to the information dynamics and areas that will not be subject to these dynamics. And so you can just see all the areas where we think this is going to play out. Car insurance, life insurance, health insurance, credit markets, pensions, short-term disability. And the areas where it will not happen is basically health insurance for the old and poverty. So most areas will be affected by these dynamics. And the fourth argument is that while these are trends, obviously, there is still some agency. Parties still matter. Politics still matters. And it matters in a fairly straightforward way. If you're a party that represents bad risks, and historically, these are left parties, even though that may be changing, doesn't matter what party it is. If parties represent bad risks or people that have higher risk, what are the kinds of policies that they can push for? We identify three, but there may be more. The first one is they can engage in what's called crowding out. So crowding out is you can make the public system really, really good. People like insurance, and if it's good public insurance, people are willing to stick with public insurance. If you give them a good healthcare system that's public, they may not want to jump on a private healthcare system. And that will shore up support for the public system. You may have to pay a price as a left party and say, okay, we allow for some segmentation. We allow people to buy extra insurance. Say you can pay extra premiums to be first in line. You can pay extra premiums to have a single hospital bed instead of being stuck with four people in a room, things like that. So that would be an example of segmentation. And people buy this insurance, and people want to have this kind of options. The second thing you can do is you can use the tax code. And the way you can use the tax code is you can, as a party, say, okay, we can have a private market for health insurance, but we do not allow you to opt out of the public system. And that generates a very obvious double payment problem where you have to pay twice to get insurance, right? First, you have to pay for the public system, and then you have to pay for the private system, and that's not really attractive. And a third thing that you can do is you can directly regulate insurance markets, and you can directly, basically, tell companies, you must not, you cannot, you're not allowed to use information of certain kinds for underwriting purposes. And in fact, we do this. Many countries have laws on the books that say you are not allowed to use DNA technology and information for underwriting purposes. Lots of countries have these kinds of laws. Now, the problem is these laws need majorities, right? They need to be passed in parliaments. They need to be enacted and so on and so forth. And it's not clear at all whether these majorities will continue to exist. And so what we try to do in the book is we try to understand what are the conditions under which there will be majorities in favor of keeping these kinds of laws or in favor of actually allowing information to be used, setting up private markets, introducing segmentation. And this is where I have bad news for you. So we go through the motions and very briefly put, this is a question of whether a majority of the population is a low-risk type or a high-risk type, which is a question of how the risk distribution looks like. So the intuition is if a majority is of low-risk type, then a majority actually benefits from a private system, at least from a purely self-interested point of view. And we find and we know that risk distributions look like this, which is that a majority is a low-risk type and a minority is a high-risk type, meaning we can't see any reason why there is political support for the public option. All right. So what we conclude is the main case against the fragmentation of risk pools is a normative one. Politically, there can be no presumption that it will win out. So it's possible that there is continued support for the welfare state and for mandatory risk pooling as we have it, but it's not the kind of logic that brought us the welfare state. It would be a completely different and new logic, at least according to our story. And that's, I find, a little scary. If you think about what modern democracies do, there's this wonderful expression. Paul Krugman uses it a lot, even though it's not from him. It's called, modern democracies are insurance companies with an army. So what modern democracies do is, it's essentially, if you look what the budgets are, it's just welfare state. It's really all we do. There's a little bit of defense, but all the rest is welfare state. It's managing risks, it's giving pensioners money, it's making sure the unemployed have money. It's really, the modern state is incredibly involved in managing people's risks and apportioning risks and taking from the lucky and giving it to the unlucky and all that. So this risk pooling that the welfare state does is a really important function of modern democracies. And I worry if that function goes away because of information, and that will sort of lead to demand of private options and segmentation, that this really important part of what modern democracies are and what holds them together will erode. And I'm not the only one that would worry about this, so I put up a couple of big thinkers here, Putnam and his social capital. So Putnam distinguishes between bonding social capital, which is not very good. So bonding social capital is if groups are feeling that they have a common cause, and that feeling comes from being everybody being the same thing, right? They all look the same, they're all the same ethnicity, they all speak the same language, and that can that can lead to a feeling of social solidarity in that group. And that often has negative consequences. He also thinks that there is a good kind of social capital, bridging social capital. And I think that risk pooling leads to this bridging capital. So the bridging capital, social capital, is that we feel connections to other classes, to other risk groups, because we rely on them. And I think that's exactly what risk pooling does, right? Risk pooling works if good and bad risks are in the same pool. It doesn't work if everybody is the same. Same thing, Durkheim, who wrote this before the welfare state, as we know it, existed, of course, but I think it's a similar idea. So Durkheim thinks that social solidarity emerges. There's two kinds. One comes in small tribal societies where, once again, everybody is the same. It's a very homogeneous society, and he calls this mechanical solidarity. And he contrasts this with social solidarity as it emerges in societies that are modern, that are large, that are heterogeneous, that are characterized by division of labor. And the reason we feel solidarity for each other, he says, is that we depend on each other and that we rely on each other, right? I'm engaging in a certain job, I need to eat, so I need to rely on farmers that I have food to buy, that sort of thing. And I think risk pooling, again, is one of these things that really enhances organic solidarity because it leads to this reliance across classes, and I rely on you to pay my pension, in return, I pay the pensions of the currently old, and so on and so forth. And if this erodes, if these mandatory risk pooling arrangements that had really broad support historically, if that is going away, then I think social solidarity is in for a rough ride. Well, that's all I wanted to say. Again, thank you for being here. Thank you for this wonderful invitation. And I'm looking forward to your questions.
Thank you so much, Philip, for this inspiring talk. I'm sure there will be questions. They can be asked either in English or in or in Italiano, se preferite.
Yeah, hi, Professor. Thank you for your lecture. It was really, really interesting. I would have like two curiosity questions. Like the first is whether you think this line of thinking can be also applied to countries that are different from the US for the way social insurance is structured or the degree of digitalization of public services or the degree of availability of information. The second question concerns like the main argument, which from what I understood is like we are passing from like asymmetric information and to more symmetric information, so more knowledge about risk. So my question is how you deal in this case with the topic, for example, of digital divide, because as I see it, it's true that maybe more knowledge on risk is leading to polarization. But maybe especially because like there is a group of people who don't have access to like information on risk. So as I see it, like it's true, but like I have some doubts on the like homogeneity of information considering the digital divide and differences on knowledge about risk within the same city, within the same country or in different countries, like higher developed or low developed countries. Thank you.
I'm happy to directly. Do you want to collect? I'm fine. Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much. So these are really interesting questions. So the first one is, all my examples are from the U.S. because that's the case I know best. But this is it's a comparative argument, and the book is comparative, right? I haven't tried to. So this book is theoretical and empirical, and the empirics is the kind of stuff I showed you, like little stories, essentially. but we're also trying to actually do sort of normal science, sort of hypothesis testing using comparative data, and the key challenge and key sort of And that was a challenge, and it was a lot of fun also to work on this project, was that it's incredibly difficult to measure information, and it's incredibly difficult, by definition, to measure private information, right? We can't observe it as scholars, just like insurance companies can't observe it. And so we are trying all sorts of ways to do this, but yes, we think this happens in all countries, certainly in all countries that have established welfare states. And so we think all countries will be affected by these kinds of scenarios. And countries that don't have welfare states yet, so the counterfactual would be, if we were 140 years ago, where there was no welfare state, and we had the kinds of information that we had today, there would be no welfare state. There would be, just wouldn't be, right? At least not, I can see why, right? We would have private solutions. And it would be very unegalitarian, right? These risk pooling welfare states that we have, they move money around a lot, right? But that's not their purpose. Their purpose is they move money from the lucky to the unlucky. And that's what moves the money. It's not because we're taxing people and giving it to poor people. That's not really the main task of the welfare state. And if we had all of this information, I don't think we had this incredibly redistributive effect of welfare states that we have historically. So that's the first. And the second is, what about people that aren't participating in this? Well, I think it's actually, so we wrote this book with this idea that there's this asymmetric information which goes away, right? First, the individual has more information than the insurance company, and we're moving to a world where they have the same information, and they have access to the same information. Well, I think it's actually getting worse, or different, where the insurance company knows more than you do. And that's certainly true with Google knows more about me than I do. I mean, they have all my emails from, I don't know, 15 years ago, and they have all the data from 15 years ago. These insurance companies have access to my medical files from 20 years ago. I mean, I don't remember my x-rays. I don't remember when I was sick. Also, I don't have all the other data points, right? My medical history is only interesting if I can compare it to other people's medical history, so I can make inferences about whether I'm a good risk to insure or a bad risk to insure. And so I think even though you may not be on Facebook or on Twitter or on any other social media, your data is there. So surely, again, in the US, your medical history is gonna be in the cloud if you go to the doctor. So unless you don't go to the doctor, you can't exit the system. You can't opt out, right? In the US, and the same must be true in Italy, I know the same is true in Germany, there are these credit companies that know or have a model that says this person is credit worthy or not, and they get a certain score, and then that determines how much you pay in interest if you take out a loan. And nobody ever asked me whether I want to be part of this. They just collect my data and sell it. I cannot opt out of these kinds of things. Just like you cannot opt out of, in the United States, again, if you apply for life insurance, there is a little known, there's a little known institution called the Medical Information Bureau, MIB. And MIB collects all of these ever-written applications for life insurance. And so if you then apply for another life insurance a year later, they check notes. They compare the two. And if you forgot to say that you smoke and one, you're in trouble, right? And so I don't think you actually can opt out. And so I'm not really active on social media. My wife doesn't use credit cards anymore since I've written this book and pays everything in cash. it's hard, right? So I think if you opt out, you will simply not have access to certain products, right? You could say to a life insurance company, I will not allow you to access my medical records. Well, that puts you in the really bad insurance category, and it makes you uninsurable, essentially. So it's not a very voluntary process as I see it.
Okay, Mr. Everson, congratulations for your lecture. I would like to listen to you about two subjects. The first is about governed behavior in front of welfare states, in particular related to aging societies. There are lots of old people. It's a problem in Italy, Japan particularly. But it's also an overlapping generation problem, and many impacts in finance, in pension, health, and so on. But I'm not sure if the government is doing his best. And the second is related to your book, how big data can help a government to manage this overlapping generation problem that is a sign of improving welfare, but it also could put your welfare at risk.
All right. So the way I understand the first question is we are in sort of the age structure of society is such that there is currently just a lot of old people receiving pensions. And so, as I said, the question is, will there be majorities to change these systems that we have, right? And if you think about the pension system, especially in societies like Italy, where the age structure is really like tilted, right? The pyramid is completely reversed. So few young people, lots of old people, then majorities will not actually be in favor of changing the status quo, right? And they vote for parties that promise generous pensions and so on and so forth. But that's sort of a short-term thing, and that will change eventually, right? I mean, there will be conditions under which there is a majority, and then old people are more likely to vote than young people, and so on and so forth. So these things will not necessarily immediately translate into politics, but I think they will put pressure on, and in other areas will actually lead to certainly slowly eroding majorities for these old risk pool arrangements, and it will it eventually has the potential that there will be majorities for policy change. So it may not necessarily be right now for pensions, but it may be right now for unemployment insurance or something like that. So that was the first. The second is whether big data also can be used to manage risks. Okay, I think that's a very good point, a very good observation. There is a bit of an upside, right? It's also very invasive. Insurance companies now know that you, so this is also comes from my own experience. So at Ohio State, we have a private health insurance through the university, and they contracted with an insurance company or with a company that tries to nudge us to live healthier lives, okay? And that means once a year I have to come in. I don't have to, but I pay more if I don't. So once a year I come in, they take my cholesterol, they take my blood pressure, they take my weight, they take they measure my waist, things like that. It's very invasive. It's very invasive. I don't know why I do this for $20 a month, but I do it for $20 a month. And so there is this, it's sort of a big brother kind of situation where the government, where the other people that pay for you tell you, you can drink, you can smoke, you can go skiing, you can do this, that, which is incredibly invasive. And in fact, historically, we have this. So before the welfare state, we have mutual aid societies. This is essentially a bunch of people in the same job, usually from the same ethnicity, in the same region. They have the same problem. They want social protection, and there isn't any. And so they get together, and they say, let's have a social protection scheme that if you're sick, you get a benefit. And if I'm sick, I'm getting a benefit, and everybody contributes, right? This existed in many, many countries at a large scale before the welfare state. And what happened is, if you stayed home, someone would knock on your door and check on you, right? So you have this really invasive monitoring going on, and that's exactly what, I mean, I feel like, I get these emails, I'm like, it's the winter, go running so you can eat turkey for Thanksgiving, that sort of thing. And I don't like them. I understand why I get them. So I think, overall we can perhaps, just like in driving, lower the overall incidence if we internalize. But then there are risks also that are completely out of my control, right? Some stuff is simply bad luck, bad genes. There is nothing you can do and you get a cancer. No matter how healthy you lived, no matter how little or whether you smoked or not, you just get it. It's other diseases, it's just tough luck. And there, it's just purely invasive. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So, 3 points and questions. The first one is about the fact that the insurance industry, as you mentioned, is not as concerning when it comes to bad driving when you compare it to, I don't know, health insurance. But we actually have cases that, for example, driving at night, right? Higher risk. Well, you have people that have to drive at night because they have to work at night. So we could possibly set that as a standard, make like a historical precedent that even these not so invasive little things can go really wrong because they are long tail problems. So the little things we cannot see, but there is nothing people can do about. So that can be set as historical precedent in some sense. The second thing is the cross-sectional. Is the risk measurement cross-sectional? I mean, all sorts of risks, like the graphs we saw. And perhaps the case could be made that nowadays, that is the distribution because of the welfare state. And if the welfare state isn't into existence, well, that wouldn't be the distribution. Third and last, to the best of my knowledge, the way we have organized ourselves politically up until now is that we knew that we belonged into a group. Now you have companies which are the ones that analyze your data, and they subgroup you into groups that you do not know that you belong to. So if there is discrimination, first, you don't know which group you belong to, so you cannot complain. And second, you do not know who else belongs to that group, so you cannot organize yourself politically. So could we be pushing more the agenda into forcing them to expose the groups that they are organizing people in? Thank you.
All right, these are really, really interesting points. So we are out of time, so I'll take the two last questions. And that's a fascinating question. So it's not entirely true that you don't know in which group you are. So, and in fact, it can be politically motivating. Again, an example from the US, from California, where if you're a driver that has all the same characteristics, but you live in a certain zip code, your premium is a lot higher, right? And people knew this. People went on the streets. It's called a ghetto tax, right? You live in a neighborhood with other bad drivers. Just so happens. And so even your 50 female driver Prius that's white, which really puts you in a very low risk category, you're going to pay a hefty premium. People know this. And people can actually get very furious. Now, I'm not sure whether people can compare their life insurance premiums, and they probably can't. And so it indeed would become very difficult to organize people's grievances with respect to risk classification going forward. And that would make everything even worse, right? Because you can't really change it. And the second was, I told you about the distribution of risk, and I told you it's bottom heavy, right? It's right skewed. And the way we know this, first of all, that's something that I've tried to figure out for the longest time of my career, how these things look like. And it's really hard because risk is a probabilistic kind of thing, right? So really, risk is a probability of something bad happening. And then something bad happens, you can observe that, but that doesn't really tell you much about the probability distribution. And so I've recently started to look at people's assessment, where I actually asked them, what is the probability of bad stuff happening to you? This all looks exactly like this. These are all bottom heavy or right skewed risk distributions. Now, risk distributions are, in fact, probably to some degree, a product of the welfare state as we know it. And so I think while people may have good reasons to go into a private system and abandon the welfare state, I think people will also be a little hesitant. So I don't think this is going to happen overnight. I think there will be pressure for segmentation. I think there will be pressure for privatization. There will be pressure for fragmentation. But people will think twice before they abandon the public system. And the kinds of things I would, if I'm a good risk, and I say, oh, I'm going to go with health insurance with this company. Well, what happens if the company goes bankrupt, right? You've paid years and years and years while you were healthy into health insurance, private health insurance, and then after 30 years it goes bankrupt and you need the insurance company, you need to collect insurance because you get sick. Well, then you actually might want to have the government around to bail these insurance companies out. So there will be countervailing forces, some of which we briefly mentioned in the book, but I still think the trend and the demand for fragmentation, segmentation, privatization is going to be there. We already see it in many countries. I think welfare states already are transforming in this way. And so I think this is a really important dynamic to understand what's going on with welfare state politics. Thank you.
So let's keep the countervailing forces as the silver lining and a warm round of applause for Professor Ram for his very fascinating talk. E grazie a tutte e tutti per essere qui e ai prossimi eventi di Biennale Tecnologia. E come sapete ce ne sono molti da adesso fino a domenica. A presto, grazie ancora.